This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCullum. The redistricting process is taking place across the country. Counties and municipalities are moving districts around, creating new voting wards, and carving out the areas that politicians represent. In a couple months, each finalized map will be sent to the state. Teams of lawyers, cartographers, and politicians will then draw new state district maps based on county and municipality lines. The process can be controversial, and generally not everyone walks away happy. There are individuals across the country making sure the process is done legally. Ray Block is one of those people. He's an assistant professor in UW-La Crosse's Political Science and Public Administration Department. Block received redistricting training from the Southern Coalition of Social Justice. I recently talked with Block about how he became an expert witness on inequality within redistricting.
To be honest, I don't know how I got wrapped up in this stuff.
But, yeah, why is that?
I have a very good colleague of mine who was formerly a professor at University of New Orleans. And because he knows another colleague of mine, he had mentioned that they were looking to recruit new expert witnesses, right? I'm a political scientist. I study voting behavior and voting patterns, so it's not a strange thing to ask someone like me to become an expert witness. But it's not the kind of job that academics go into their, you know, go into their careers looking for. So essentially, these people who were in charge of training and recruiting new expert witnesses, they had a program in August of 2010. And the way they laid it down to us, they were worried that the careers of the current generation of expert witnesses will soon be over, in a sense that many of them are reaching the age of retirement and they need new blood. So they brought some of us in. Some of us knew what we were getting into. Others, like me, did not know what they were getting into. And they trained us. We spent the week learning things related to redistricting and voter participation, and they also brought in a community of cartographers and geographers. So this idea is you want social scientists from different stripes to get together to learn about the process of redistricting, so that when the next census tracts roll around and people start making decisions about the new wave of districts, these social scientists can be useful to politicians and to activists and to attorneys.
And why is it important to have so many different people involved and different sides coming together to talk with politicians about redistricting?
Well, according to the people that I were trained under, they simply said that at some point, if we don't keep the numbers high, there just won't be people there to provide this kind of resource. Like I say, for academics, this is not the kind of, it's not a traditional route for a person's career to go in. It's a very hard career to do. And the work is actually, I'm not saying it's thankless, but it's very stressful for not very much benefit. So they were worried that if they didn't recruit very hard, that they wouldn't have a lot of people signing up for this kind of work. And it would make sense that you'd have sociologists, political scientists, demographers, cartographers, and various other statistically trained geographers working on this kind of thing.
So can you talk about the training you've received from the Southern Coalition of Social Justice and how you've applied that to real life redistricting processes since then?
All right. So I do, redistricting is a big process. I'm a small piece of that process. So everything I tell you here is only related to this little itty bitty teeny tiny portion of it, right? But I do what is called racially polarized voting analyses. Essentially what that means is I play detective, for lack of a better term, and I may get recruited or I may work for free. And what I'll do is people will ask me a very specific question. They'll ask me that in the event that there is litigation or if there's some court case involving someone trying to defend current district plans or to revise current district plans, they want to know whether or not, based on what we consider to be the constitutional bases for drawing districts, if those districts have been drawn in compliance with federal law, right? Now, because I study racially polarized voting, am asked specifically about the racial breakup of members inside of districts. And I usually fall back on what we say is our federal law. So our federal law dictates that we're looking for some very specific things when districts are drawn up. One is we have to see whether, historically speaking, the districts are drawn in such a way that they are meant not to dilute the votes of certain minority groups, racial and ethnic minority groups. That is something that the Constitution defends. In this case, if it is an instance of racially polarized voting, if I can isolate that, then people can argue one of two things. They can argue that such districts are bad, or they can argue that such districts are good. I do not make the arguments. I am a statistician in this case. I am simply usually recruited to see whether or not, for example, certain minority groups tend to favor one politician over another, or if whites prefer one politician over another. If that can be established, then arguments about the fairness or the justness of such instances can be debated in court. And if need be, I'll be taken into court and I'll be actually sworn in and I'll have to be cross-examined to talk about the validity of the claims I've made about racially polarized voting. So from my perspective, what I do is I go and I find pieces of information and art naturally grouped together. So I'll get a combination of voting records from local community resources, and I'll combine that with census information about the racial makeup of particular districts. I'll put that information together and I'll check to see whether or not, based on the voting record, if there is something that looks like racial polarization. For example, if I can infer from the racial or ethnic breakup in a district and the voting returns for particular candidates in a district, if there is some instance or some argument you can make about the instance of racially polarized voting. Now, here's where my job gets kind of tricky. You don't have individual motivation, right? So everything that I'm telling you here is based on what we call an ecological inference problem. And what that is you are trying to infer what people are doing when you don't have the intentions of what people are doing. You have the result of behaviors, right? And this is a good thing. I would hate to have my information about who I prefer as a candidate tracked by the ballot, right? You can ask survey questions about this thing, but survey questions, as everyone knows, have motivations to them. People can tell the truth or they cannot tell the truth, right? So statistically speaking, it's a very interesting problem for people like me who like data-related problems. And that problem is, how do I, based on vote returns and population demographics, figure out statistically what might be the trends in these areas? A lot of the stuff that's related to the training that I got in redistricting has to do with Southern politics. Now, before I got here, I was at Florida State University. The people that trained me were people that are working out of Duke University's Center for Racial and Ethnic Studies. And what we were doing there is looking very historically at tendencies that we know in race relations. And those tendencies suggest that usually you can expect instances of racially polarized voting. And it's not always because of race, but there are artifacts within it that lead to these expectations being met. For example, if you think about political party and race, right now it's a safe bet. If you're assuming you're trying to think about what the racial breakdown would be of vote support for a particular candidate, African Americans, at least in recent history, have been shown to support Democratic as opposed to Republican candidates. So things like party identification, socioeconomic status, and race relations history, for lack of a better term, figure prominently into these kinds of things.
And what I'm assuming the three things you're looking at, and this I know are three things that here in La Crosse County and counties throughout the country are looking at avoiding, are packing, fracturing, and gerrymandering. Uh-huh. So are these three things that you are making sure that states and districts are not doing? And I'm wondering if you can give explanation to the listeners as to what those three things are.
All right, stacking first, right? So stacking is this idea that you have groups of voters and you contain groups of voters within a particular district. In other words, you might have a traditionally Hmong area and you know that the voice of Hmong people in that area will be louder than it would be if you, quote unquote, fractured that particular boundary
and
broke them up into other districts, right? Now, gerrymandering, for lack of a better term, is the misapplication of redistricting practices. So when things go awry or when things do not fall within compliance of federal law, then people can argue that these are arbitrarily drawn districts. When I say arbitrarily, I kind of wink at you when I say it, because what I'm saying here is that they don't fit within the classic determinants of how districts should be drawn. And very quickly, those determinants are districts should be what they call continuous, in the sense that you can't have one district and then like a boundary ending and then it's being picked up at some other place. To the extent that it's possible, you want the population sizes within districts to be similar. Now, it varies by state. how similar they need to be. Some states allow for more what they call deviation than other states do. And you want compactness in the sense that you want, at least from a mathematical sense, to say that these are district lines that make sense. And this is an informal requirement, but to the extent that you can, you don't want to break up communities of interest. So there are historical reasons for keeping certain neighborhoods together. And those historical reasons need to be taken into account. Of course, you go down a list of many things before you get to talking about communities of interest, but those things are something that should be played in, you know, they play a part as well.
So there, it seems to be that there's a fine line between, you know, keeping among neighborhood together, for example, but then also stacking them together.
Right.
How do you draw that line, or how do you see when maybe it's not been done in the proper way or a legal way?
Uh-huh. So this is the thing that makes this stuff fun, right? And by fun, I mean controversial. So if we just take this into something that's widely debated, so one of the debates that goes on is whether or not majority-minority districts or majority-coalition districts are useful and necessary. Now, majority-minority districts are simply districts where you can say, mathematically speaking, there's a large enough density of minorities in an area to make it majority-minority, right? Majority-coalition districts are districts where you have combinations of different racial and ethnic groups, and if you combine those racial and ethnic groups, you have a numerical majority. Now, there are arguments both ways. For example, if you have a strong voice in a particular district, then there's the likelihood that that voice will actually be heard by politicians. There's even a likelihood that an elected politician might actually look like or substantively represent the interest among people. But there are also counterarguments, and the counterargument is doing so might mean that if you concentrate the voices within one district, then you minimize the voices within another. And as a strategy, it might be very good for you to minimize the voices in outlying districts by concentrating them within a particular district where the overall result means that you don't get that voice heard in the aggregate. So what I've been doing lately, and as much like there's very little I can talk about now with it because I'm currently doing it, is I'm actually dealing with attorneys in the state of North Carolina. And one of the questions that's being looked into is whether or not within the state, if previously delineated majority-minority districts have passed their utility. And there are some arguments that are very strong on both sides. The people that are arguing for dismantling these kinds of majority-minority districts are making a very good point about representation. And their point about representation is if you look at milestones in race relations, lots of milestones have been hit, particularly when it comes to race relations and political candidates. And we currently have a president that represents a different group being in office. People that want to preserve these majority-minority districts will argue that if you didn't have these majority-minority districts, you wouldn't get people of color winning elections for Congress or winning elections for state, you know, state Senate and state House. So there are arguments that are very strong on both sides. It's like I say, it's not up to me as an academic to debate this stuff. I love debating this stuff, but that's not my job as a redistrictor. My job is simply to argue that if you can say there is polarization in the patterns of people, then there is a reason to actually sit back and think very hard about how you're going to draw districts in the next round, particularly if drawing the districts can either dilute or concentrate the voices of particular groups of people.
So is that what most of this comes down to, is fair representation?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes down to fair representation. And what is considered fair is relative, right? So if, for example, racial and ethnic equality is the standard by which you judge fairness, then possibly majority-minority districts are something that's sensible and necessary. If overall representation is the argument that you're pushing, then there could be a very good counterargument for majority-minority districts in the sense that they favor certain kinds of groups and they work specifically towards putting certain groups into districts together with the hope of getting representatives that represent those interests.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is Ray Block. He's a UW La Crosse assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration. I'm wondering if next we could talk about redistricting at a state level. I know you're not involved in the Wisconsin redistricting process. You said you're looking at things going on in North Carolina. How much can people at a local level really make a difference when it comes to state redistricting? We just had the counties just finished their redistricting process. It's now moved on to the municipalities. Eventually, in Wisconsin, Michael Best and Friedrich, they're a major law firm in the state, they'll be charged with redistricting the state. So what can average people, what difference can they make if it's in the hands of a law firm eventually?
Well, the thing that I know mostly about is that what I've been doing so far has really focused heavily on communities of interest. And representatives from communities of interest do not run firms. They're not attorneys. They're not even politicians for the most part. They're community activists. And community activists are not barred from the redistricting process. Of course, we all play our roles, but the roles we play are important roles. And people in communities of interest are able to learn more about the redistricting process. When it's open to the public, they are able to sit in on some of the decision-making meetings that occur at the local level when it comes to redistricting. And sometimes their input is solicited, if not encouraged. And so on that level, things can be done by quote-unquote normal people to make sure that the process at least is more transparent, if not more fair.
How widespread is inequality in the redistricting process nationally?
Nationally? That's a question I'm not really able to answer. I will say the answer is somewhere between. There's a non-trivial amount to there may not be any amount at all. But I would say it's closer to a non-trivial amount. Okay. I can only speak with the states that I know about. And I wouldn't be surprised if other states were struggling with this issue. In fact, I expect other states to be struggling with this.
A couple months back, you spoke at a League of Women Voters here in La Crosse, a meeting that they had. Mm-hmm. And John Mettinger was also there, and he is on the county board. He's been a politician within the La Crosse area for many years. And I thought it was interesting some of the points he had to make. And he's had quite an interesting look inside the redistricting process throughout the years. He had mentioned at one point that redistricting is all about power. At one point he said it's an insider's baseball kind of game. I want to play you this story he had told me about his time redistricting at the state level.
I was in the state legislature for 16 years, and in that time I went through two different redistrictings after the decennial census. And at that time we had two Democratic state representatives, Virgil Roberts, the late great Virgil Roberts, and myself. And we had to, kind of take a look at how you're going to divvy up 99 seats in the state assembly. Well, let me kind of back into that by saying I think most people know that State Representative Jennifer Schilling's seat right now is a pretty heavily Democratic district. Mike Hipsch's, which Steve Doyle, a Democrat, just won, had traditionally been a very Republican district. And at that point, the other political party is not very competitive. It would be hard for a Republican to win against Jennifer, and in the past it was almost impossible for a Democrat to win against Mike Hipsch. So what Virgil and I did, and I would argue that it's actually good government, is my district, the 95th district, which Jennifer represents now, it was getting more and more Democratic. Virgil Roberts, the 94th Assembly District, was getting more and more Republican. It's a typical thing of older, mature cities versus, wealthy suburbs and things like that. So both times that we redistricted, I gave Virgil a few Democratic wards, and he would give me a few Republican areas. I would argue that it would give us both a chance to win, two Democrats, which is partisan politics, but I would also argue that it's good government because it made two competitive assembly districts where the Republicans and Democrats both had a chance to win either one. So even though it has political overtones and trying to maybe enhance the Democratic Party, I think it's kind of like what the League of Women Voters, the good government people, have always wanted, which is competitive races, competitive assembly districts. And so I think you can argue it from a good government viewpoint that what we did, even though it may have benefited Virgil and allowed me to kind of hang on to my seat, did put us in a position where the Republicans had a shot at both seats.
So the story that Mettinger told, is it typical that politicians do play such a role in the redistricting process? And maybe what are your thoughts on that?
Well, to a point, I agree with everything that Mettinger said. So if this is really ultimately about power, and people will argue that politics is ultimately about power, then those who want power will seek to gain power. And sometimes you gain power at the expense of your opponents. Now, in this case, the party in power actually has final say in how district lines are drawn. Now, based on that idea and based on this notion that power drives ultimately what's happening with redistricting, then it would make sense that the party in power would find ways to maximize its political voice. And that may or may not mean minimizing the voice of the opposing party. Sometimes you can strike deals the way that Menninger's story implies. And the conflict itself, I do agree, is what democracy is all about. So, like, without the conflict, the decision-making would be a lot worse in a sense that there'd be very little input from the opposing side. But the cynic in me has to sit back and simply say that if there is an instance where power brokering is going to take place, I would expect the party in power to want to have the lion's share of the political standing from redistricting, and that would mean, if possible, maximizing the voice that they have and possibly minimizing the voice of their opponents.
Do you think it's fair that politicians have a role in the redistricting process?
I think it's inherent to the position because redistricting works along with reapportionment. The idea that you're trying to figure out how leaders are going to deal with constituents. And if you have that wrapped up in how district lines are going to be drawn, then it is ultimately a political process. As bad or as good as that sounds, I believe that we can't divorce the politics from it. And I don't think we should be able to. I think it's actually part of the game.
I'm curious if you have an opinion on this. In an ideal world, how would you handle redistricting?
In an ideal world, it would simply be population number, right? In an ideal world, we'd have no communities of interest. We'd have no racial cleavages. We'd have no class cleavages. We'd have no ethnic cleavages. And we'd have extraordinarily civil party competitions, right? That world doesn't exist. Now, in a world that looked like that from far away, then you would simply go by population characteristics. You'd make sure that you divided districts up so that they had equal numbers of people throughout. And of course, you can't draw district lines through rivers and railroads and like geographically unfeasible blocks of land, right? That would be the main issue. Now, we hope ultimately to get back to that kind of thing. But for now, that world that we just talked about, that ideal one, it just doesn't mesh with the reality of things. And in the reality of things, drawing these lines becomes extraordinarily difficult because there are people to please and people to upset. And it's very difficult to maximize the justification that you have for the line drawing because every decision comes at the cost of making someone or some group upset.
Ray Block is an assistant professor in UW-La Crosse's Department of Political Science and Public Administration. I recently spoke with Block about identifying racial inequality in the redistricting process. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear two La Crosse City Council members talk about the city's redistricting efforts. Also, how the new voter ID law could affect Wisconsin residents. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum.